I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Or my mom. My mom will do it for me. She, like this, she's the reason I hate computers.
Because she's great at them?
Yeah, she taught it. Like, she taught computer education and business science at the college level. She wrote textbooks on computers. And so, because of that, I hate them. I try
Does
to stay
know?
As far away from them as possible. Oh, she knows, yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I
That's so wild.
She knows. But my son is all over it. He's
yeah,
like a
sure.
computer genius. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like computers are like there's no way they're not all computer geniuses because they're like soaking it up from like, you know, zero to whatever. They're 10 years old. They got 10 years experience. I'm like, I still don't have 10 years experience. What?
Yeah. Totally. Like he makes like Lego movies and he does YouTube videos where he just bitches about the world. And like,
how old is your son?
Plays video games. He's 11.
That's so funny. I'm legit imagining like a 3-year-old bitching about the world. Like, listen, I'm tired of it.
No. He's 11, and if like a movie he doesn't like, he'll just come out. Like, he ripped apart the last Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi. I don't know if he ever like posted it on YouTube, but he had like this huge long like tirade where he went off on it for a half hour.
That's so funny. You know, I was going to ask you, because I've thought about this with my kids, is like, do you think your kids will get into theater? Like, because you didn't get into computers because your mom was doing that. Are your kids going to get into theater, or are they going to be like, no thanks?
Well, both of them actually are taking classes at one of the theaters that I teach at. and so... My daughter, I think, will be a performer. She's almost 9, and she's just on fire. And my son, I think he's going to be a really good, like, I think he's probably going to get into technical theater. I think he's going to do lights and sound, or he's going to write or direct or something. But my daughter's a performer. She's actually, for her birthday last year, for her 8th birthday, what she wanted to do was have all of her friends come to the theater that I run, and have my cast, my unscripted cast, improvise a Christmas play that she got to be in.
And they
so,
did it?
So she was, oh yeah, yeah, and she was rad. Like, it was a whole story about how Santa Claus had the flu, and an elf flew into her where she lived and told her that she needed to save Christmas because she had elf in spirit, because she was a decent, like a descendant of Santa Claus or something. And it was crazy. It was 40 minutes long. And she just did this one act play, and she was all over it. It was rad.
That's so great.
It was like the highlight of my life. Yeah, it was cool.
That's so fun.
It was super cool.
Tell me
so,
about
yeah,
Unscripted.
I think
what's Unscripted like?
It's what we're pretty good at. So the theater that I run, which is Majestic Playhouse, half of our shows are completely improvised every season. So we do 3 or 4 productions that are typical scripted shows, and then we do 3 or 4 productions that are improvised plays, and they run just like a regular play for us. We do a full-on rehearsal period. We have show-specific sets, show-specific costumes, and we have a regular cast that, you know, varies between 6 and 10. And we pick a genre, we research the genre, we study the genre, and then we improvise full-length plays in that genre or in that style. And we started that 3 years ago, I think. It all started out as a joke, to be honest with you. We had just done like a short-form improv show, and me and one of my friends, we were talking back and forth, and we were doing like 1930s standard American dialect and doing like the Cary Grant, the quick, you know, witty repartee stuff. And we're like, hey, we should turn this into an unscripted play. And then like next week, we're like, let's do it. And then 4 weeks later, we opened it and we started with 9 shows, and it sold pretty well. And then we started joking about doing improvised Hallmark Christmas movies. So we did them, and yeah, everything's been a joke. So we've done improvised Hallmark Christmas movies. We've done improvised or unscripted Agatha Christie plays. We've done 1960s spy thrillers, like early James Bond. We've done B movies, like 1950s low budget sci-fi movies. We're in rehearsal now for unscripted ghost stories for Halloween, and then A Very Merry Unscripted Christmas comes back in December, and we'll do the 3rd year of Hallmark shows. So they're really, to be honest with you, what keeps the doors of the theater open.
The Christmas shows?
Just the improv shows in general.
Really?
The unscripted shows are, yeah. I mean, our scripted shows, our traditional plays sell pretty well. But if we could do an entire season of unscripted shows, we would probably be looking for a bigger venue. But I have a wife and kids that want to see me every once in a while, and an Australian shepherd that gets super angry when I'm not there to walk him and play with him.
Sure.
So I can't do every show.
But do you do every unscripted show as it is? Like, there's people that do... Is there, like, a company that does the scripted theater and then a company that does the unscripted theater?
It's kind of all one big thing. I'm the co-artistic director of Majeska Playhouse, but the artistic director of Majeska Unscripted, which is the unscripted section. So I try really hard during the scripted plays to not be at the theater so much, because I'm usually in rehearsal or prepping the genre for the next unscripted show. So they really go every other play is unscripted.
So you get time off like every couple months. You get a month off here, a month off there.
That's pretty much the way it works, yeah. We typically rehearse for 5 to 6 weeks, and then we have a 4-week run. So we're looking at about 10 weeks of total rehearsal and production time, and then we go dark with the unscripted. We bring in, you know, Neil Simon or whatever we're doing for a scripted play, and then we start researching the next genre, and then we go into rehearsal for that. So I usually get like a month off where I can see my kids and hang out and reconnect with my wife and see what color her hair is now, and play with my dog and ride my bike. But yeah, it's pretty busy.
So is it the same, like, is it a troupe, like the same people every time that do the unscripted shows, or do you like do auditions once a year, or has it been the same people doing it? Like, was it the improv crowd and that's who does it? How do you figure out who the actors are for the unscripted?
We basically have a company of 6 now that do pretty much every show. If somebody needs a, you know, a run off or a production off, they could take that production off. But there's a group of 6 of us that started the theater, or some of the unscripted portion, and we've kind of stuck together this whole time. If we feel like we need to have a bigger cast, we hold auditions. And we have some people that we just kind of keep bringing in and bringing back. So what we kind of have is we have like a company, and then we have guest performers that we invite to come and do shows. And then we have a third tier of just people that audition, like a traditional play.
Which is
hard because...
Yeah. Do those 6 people do all of the shows, like both the scripted and the unscripted?
No, those 6 just do the unscripted.
Okay.
Every once in a while.
That's a lot.
Yeah, totally. Every once in a while, we'll have one of them do a scripted show. If there's a scripted show they really want to do, sure. They come in and they can audition for it. I think last year we did the Hallmark Christmas shows. Then a scripted play that I directed and one of our unscripted actors was in it, and then Agatha Christie. So we were in 3 shows in a row together. So starting in November and ending in April, I think. He's young and single, and my wife was pissed. So we've decided not to do that so much.
It sounds so intense.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty fun though. I get texts from her like at rehearsal. I'm at rehearsal. I get texts from her, you know, your damn dog won't come inside. Your kids are yelling because, you know, they haven't seen you. You know, I miss you. typical things. Yeah.
Classic theater wife stuff.
Classic theater. Yeah, I wasn't doing theater anymore when we got married. It didn't come back until a year or so after we got married. So she didn't know what she was getting into.
So let's go back then. I want to talk to, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Orange County, California. Super suburban, super relatively conservative, pretty close to the beach. Super sun, a lot of sunshine and a lot of outdoor activities, and that's kind of what I grew up doing was riding bicycles and hiking and camping and backpacking and things like that. And so I didn't find theater until I think I was in the eighth grade, and I was at some anniversary party for my parents' friends, and this guy that was there came up to me and he said, and I said, no. And he's like, you want to learn how to juggle? And I said, okay. And so he took me out to his juggling studio because it was at his parents' house. And he taught me how to do a basic three-ball juggle. And I thought, wow, this is pretty fun. And he told me all about street performing and that he was a street performer and said that he was making a pretty decent living at it. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm 13. I can be a street performer. So I started juggling at stoplights. Like, that was my job in eighth grade. Was, you know those people that spin the signs around for like model homes and things like that?
Yeah.
Or to tell you where the furniture sale is? I got a job doing that. But what I did was I set the sign up pointing in the direction that we wanted people to go. And then I would do like a 90-second juggling routine at every stoplight. And then then people started throwing pennies at me. And so then I realized, wow, I could make extra money. So I took my 90-second juggling routine and turned it into a 60-second juggling routine where I just did like all my best juggling tricks that a 14-year-old boy could do. And then I would run through all the stopped cars with like a hat or a bag, and people would put money in it. And then I was walking home with a couple $100 a day.
Wow.
In change. Yeah, it was pretty rad. And then the cops put an end to it, and I wasn't allowed to do that anymore.
Sure. Yeah, they don't like that.
Apparently they don't like 14-year-old kids running through traffic collecting money after juggling. Yeah, they got mad. And so I started taking acting classes, and that's kind of all through high school. That was pretty much what kept me in school, was doing acting classes there. And then I went off to acting school and studied improv and did circus school for a little while. And
wait, don't glaze over that. That's where, hold on. You you said you went to acting school first. Did you go to like a conservatory, or did you go to a liberal arts school and get a theater degree?
Well, my mom and dad were super, and are still super, super supportive of me doing theater. And so when I graduated high school, they said, you need to go to 1 year of community college just to get moving a little bit, and then you can go where you want to go. So I did my 1 year of community college, and then I transferred to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, which is an acting only school. And it was a 2-year conservatory program. And then from there, I went and studied at South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa, California. And then from there, I went to, I met a teacher by the name of Ron Balsam, who was a founding artist at SCR, who was very much into physical theater and movement. And I really took to that. So I started studying clown with various teachers, and then I went to the San Francisco School of Circus Arts at the time and was studying clown there a little bit. And I started creating physical clown pieces that were very much like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin, not so much like circus and birthday party clowns. And then I started taking improv classes to learn how to improvise physically and take improv and turn it into clown work. But then the improv stuff stuck and I quit doing clown, was just doing improv. Then I decided I wanted to make a living. So I signed aboard a tall ship. I don't know. If, yeah, you know the, it was a replica of a boat from the early 1800s. So it looked like a pirate ship.
Yeah.
And I had a job there. I had a job there where what I would do was, it was all in costume and character. And we would teach these programs, these living history programs that were anywhere from 18 hours long to 9 days. And the boat would go sailing. And so I learned how to sail all these traditional sailing ships and things like that. And it was all improvised. Like all that you had things that you had to teach, but since it was in costume and character and there was six or seven other people on board, it was like creating a play every night, or every day. And so I did that for a while.
I like how that's your like real job. You're like, so I had to get a real, job and I went to the tall ships. I thought you were going to be like, so I was a sailor for 6 years and I'd be like, whoa, what? And then you're like, okay, no. But that like idea, the idea of that, not only like as an educational opportunity, like I want to go on that, but also like,
it was so
what a
fun.
Cool gig.
Yeah, it was so fun. I mean, I had the best time. And then what happened was, we were making like $15 an hour to go sailing for 9 days at a time and sail all up and down California, the California coast. And we got to shoot cannons and dress in costume and live on the boat. And it was super fun. And then the captain of the boat at the time sat me down and he said, how many days have you been doing this? And I said, I have about 780 days at sea or whatever. And he suggested that I sit for my captain's license, because I could get a pay raise to do that. And I could go on as the second ticket. So what that meant was if the boat was out for longer than 12 hours, they had to carry two captains. And the main captain would have all the responsibility. And then the second captain was just there to like oversee the second watch or whatever. And, so I sat for my captain's exam. I got a 200-ton master's license to sail tall ships and other boats. And I was like, oh, this is fun. I'm sailing my boat. I'm hanging out with my friends. And then the captain came up to me and he said, hey, I just got a job on the East Coast on a different boat. And I was like, well, what does that mean for me? And he said, well, it means you're the captain of this boat now. So I was a captain of a tall ship for like 3 years. And that was my off time where I wasn't doing any plays. I wasn't doing any improv. I wasn't doing any acting.
But you kind of were.
I was just, I kind of was. Yeah. So I was the captain of the ship.
Is this when your wife met you?
Yeah, it was pretty close. Yeah.
So it was like ship captain Chris that she was like wooed by.
Yeah. She actually met me as Sully because everybody called me Sully.
Sure.
And why wouldn't I?
Perfect.
She's Sully.
Yeah, and, just be yourself, but also be total ship captain-y. Absolutely, that's so great.
Yeah, absolutely. My hair is super long, super bleached out. I had this, like, huge, turn-of-the-century goatee. I was brown and weathered. And, we met at a play. To see if we had a mutual friend. And so we went to the play. I instantly fell in love with her. And then I got sent to the Caribbean for 3 months to work on a job. And so we emailed each other every night. And that's how we met. We dated via email. Which was cool. It gave me time to think of witty responses and things. So she would think I was funny and charming.
Yeah. So fun.
And so then when I came back, it was great. It was great. And then I came back and I sailed on the boat for a while longer. And then my two high school friends and I, who had literally known each other most of our lives, were like, hey, it's time to start a theater. We're all back in Orange County. And so we started the theater company and I quit the boat and started teaching theater and improv at different locations to make a little bit of money, and that's where we're at now.
So, I love that you were a ship captain. I also, by the way, love that even though you had just met this girl and you were like totally into it, that you still went to the Caribbean. You were like, oops, well, this is a great opportunity. You're nice, but we'll talk, I promise. Like, that's so on point because, like, I don't know, for me, I was always like that, you know, like when I was in the beginning of my career and I was doing stuff, I would like, I would take the job over the date every time. I'd be like, oh my God, you're super nice. I like this, but I have to go stage manage this thing in Connecticut. I'll see you later. You know, it's just funny how it's like gig first, then we'll figure out the personal stuff.
Yeah, this was for a really, like, a ridiculously tiny role in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. So it was like, how do I turn out? How do I turn down drinking rum with, you know, Johnny Depp and Keira Knightley? So I went.
So did you get that acting gig because you had your captain license?
Kind of, yeah. They called in. They sent out casting notices to all the ships on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And I went in for the audition. And it was really, really weird. Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer, was there. And Gore Verbinski, the director, was there. And they just brought us in, like a typical cattle call audition. And they wanted skinny, angular guys. And that was what I was at the time. And they're like, hey, can you take your shirt off? And so they had all of us take our shirts off to see how skinny we were. And we were all pretty fit because we were working on boats, but we were all super white because we had to wear shirts while we were sailing because we were teaching kids.
Sure.
But we were all just super, super pale, except for, like, our arms and legs. And they looked at my resume and they said, you have an acting degree too? And I said, yeah. I'm like, all right, we'll see you in the Caribbean. And it was that quick. It was crazy.
Wow.
So I went there. I hung out with Jeffrey Rush and Johnny Depp, and we were all on this tiny little island together, and it was really weird and sort of surreal. And I sat in this dingy hotel and emailed my wife to be every night while the fleas were biting me. And it was cool. It was super cool. And then I realized I never wanted to do film again.
Sure, because of all the waiting around?
Because of all the waiting around, yeah.
Yeah.
But I made an obscene amount of money for doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And
it
was crazy.
And I've made more for 30 seconds of my time than I have for, like, 9 years. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, what?
Absolutely. I came home after that. I paid off my credit card. I put, like, I felt rich, so I put this super big lift on my Jeep that I had at the time, and I bought an identical bicycle to what Lance Armstrong rode in the Tour de France. And then all of a sudden I was broke again, but I had those really cool things.
Sure.
So, yeah.
I hope you either used that bike or you sold it for profit.
No. I still have it. I can't sell it. It actually... I had a custom made, and if you know Disneyland at all, the restaurant inside the Pirates of the Caribbean is called the Blue Bayou. And I always thought it was funny that, you know, I considered myself a relatively fast rider. And so I'd be like, hey, I blew by you. And so when I got the bike, I had a color match to be this dark blue, and it has Blue Bayou across the top tube written. So I can never sell it. So, you know.
You just filled with your own jokes. I love it.
Yeah, so yeah, everything's fun. My own joke.
Man, that story of the casting is like the exception to the rule where people say, like, you can't get anything with a theater degree. Turns out you got in that movie because of it. It was like, hey, bunch of people that worked on a boat, you look kind of the part. This one guy, though, does theater. Get him in. Love
and
it.
He does. And what's crazy is they took me over to the Caribbean, and they had all these big plans of saying, wow, this guy knows how to climb aloft in a rig. He knows how to sail these boats. We're going to use this to our advantage. And then I get over there and they say, oh, you're an actor now. You're not allowed to touch any of the rigs. You're not allowed to touch the ropes. You're not allowed to work the sail. You're not allowed to do anything.
Yep.
And I was like, are you kidding me? And the deck crew of the boat that was over there, they all knew me. So they would always, like, when we weren't shooting or something, they'd walk up to me and they'd be like, hey, Sully, lay aloft and furl the course. And so I'd have to go up in the rig and furl sails. And I was constantly sneaking around and doing super fun stuff. And then one day there was this, it was going to be a 12-hour day. It was a huge, long day. We were all going to get huge pay bumps and things like that. And it was going to be a sailing shot, and then we knew all these helicopter shots. And the wind was really good, and we were out sailing, and this guy comes up on deck, and he's wearing my costume. And he has, like, this, he has a fake beard put on, and he has a fake wig put on. And I was like, who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm your sailing double. And I said, what? He's like, yeah, I'm your sailing double. You're just an actor. And I said, I took off my wig, and I said, this is bull. I'm not doing this anymore. And I said, I know plenty about sailing this boat. And the guy was like, yeah, really? Where's this one line? He's like, where's the four-course halyard on the starboard side? And I said, well, it's right here. And I pointed to one of the 150 lines that were on the boat. And I said, it's right here. And then Marty, one of the guys that was in the cast, walked by and just goes, Sully's an effing captain, and just kept walking. And then the guy looked at me and he's like, you're a captain? And I said, yeah, I'm the captain of, you know, this boat. And the guy's like, oh, I'm sorry, sir. And he took off his wig, and he took off his fake beard and everything. And he's like, I'm not sailing for you. And then he went and sat down. And so there's all these shots of the boat, and I'm not in them because I wasn't allowed to sail the boat, and my sailing double wouldn't do it for me.
So weird.
Yeah, I just got to go on a free sailing day. It was super fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever.
It's just funny how, yeah, like I understand the, you know, sort of like the thing about insurance and stuff, like, so the actors can do X amount of stuff and then the other part of the crew can do it. But it seems so unusual that they would have required you to have the knowledge and then not had you use it. So weird.
Yeah, it was kind of a drag. It was kind of a drag, and I kept promising, you know. But, you know, it is what it was.
Sure. Yeah, film stuff is so weird.
Yeah. I'm sure I wouldn't. I think it's pretty doubtful that I would be married to who I am now if I had stayed in California. So I just figured that it was all for the best. It was just like this perfect little romantic, you know, rom-com where I had to go sail a boat in the Caribbean so I could, you know, woo my wife or whatever. So
I like how
I'm pretty good at it.
In this story, you seem to have a bit more fun than your wife's character. Like, she just stays at home. So she does her regular job, and you get to sail the Caribbean.
Yeah. And it hasn't totally changed either. And this is why my wife is so just crazy rad, because she has a rhythm. I mean, she's an art teacher, which is cool, but she teaches at a public school, and she teaches art, and she has that, you know, that high-paying public educator job while I'm out.
I feel like you're being facetious.
A little bit, but just about the high-paying part.
Yeah.
The high-paying part. But,
I was going to be like, really? Yeah. You're in California? Okay, public teachers, take note.
So she kind of holds down the fort while I get to go out and try to create theater and do unscripted plays and all that stuff. But I teach at a couple of different places. Like, I'm literally sitting in the bowels of the Orange County School of the Arts right now, which is a arts high school in Santa Ana, California.
It's a high school.
I just got off. Yeah, it's 7th grade all the way through 12th grade. And I teach improvisation here for the Acting Conservatory. And so, yeah, I'm actually heading to rehearsal right after this because I am taking 26 freshmen to seniors, and they are learning how to improvise a full-length play in the style of 1950s science fiction space movies.
So tell me how you got to this. Like, how did you go from, so you're a ship captain, you go and do the acting on the Pirates of the Caribbean, you're like, forget film, I'm not into it, I want to go back to my theater roots. You get in touch with your, like, high school friends who all just happened to come by the way, total movie. All your high school friends come together, you guys all decide to start a theater together. Classic. And you guys all started, was that Majeska Playhouse that you guys started?
Yeah, it was actually it was me and my two buddies from high school. We used to sit around in the theater during lunch because we weren't jocks and we were afraid to go outside. So we would sit around in the theater and we would talk about like our dreams. And we all had these great dreams of starting a theater company. And when you're 16, you want to go somewhere cool like Seattle or Portland or San Francisco and start a theater there. and so that was like what we'd always talk about. And then we all graduated and went our separate ways and had careers and got married and sailed boats and all this stuff. And then when we started when we started having kids, we moved back to Orange County. And one night we were just hanging out in a bar, the three of us, and we're like, hey, let's start that theater company we kept talking about so many years ago. And then somebody else will be like, yeah, that's a great idea. Oh yeah, why don't we just come back next week with like name ideas for the theater? So that's literally how it started. Like, we were just sitting around at a bar and we're like, let's do this. And the next week we came back and we had Majeska Playhouse, which is a really cool name and also really difficult to spell, so it's probably not a good name for marketing.
What does it mean?
Helena Majeska was a Shakespearean actress from Poland, and she moved to Orange County, California, and started an arts colony literally like 5 miles from where the theater is. And there's this mountain range that kind of shadows over all of South Orange County. And one of the peaks is Majeska Peak. And so we thought that was cool to have the connection to Helena Majeska and the connection to the mountain peak. So we just called it Majeska Playhouse, just off a whim, and it kind of stuck. So that's where we're at. So, yeah,
I think if it's like a place in the area, it's not that crazy a marketing ploy. Like, if it was just a random word that nobody had ever heard of, but if it's like there's something in the area that everybody's familiar with that has that name, you know, the mountain peak.
Yeah, it's so ridiculously hard to spell.
Sure.
It's still super hard to spell. And we get people saying it's the Majestic Theater or the Magical Theater or whatever, but, you know. It's a cool name, and when we started doing the unscripted shows and started calling it Majeska Unscripted Theater, that was a little hard to like to submit to festivals because it wasn't like a clever funny name.
Is that what they're looking for at festivals? I think there's a lot of improv festivals out there, and they're like, this one's not a pun. Throw it out.
Yeah, kind of.
Really?
Some of those names stick around. No, I mean, they're looking for, like, ability and what your format is, but people will certainly remember some names. They don't necessarily remember Majeska Unscripted.
Sure.
So we actually just call ourselves Mutt. We just call ourselves Mutt now most of the time. And that works okay, I suppose. It's no Groundlings, but...
Yeah, but the word Groundlings is so random. You know what I mean? Like, people only know it because they know it.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean? Like, that's nobody true. Would know anything. You know, like, every name that, like, there's all sorts of random crap that we know, like, about the improv world because we're in it. Whereas if you say these words to people on the outside, like, even when, like, because I teach too, and I teach improv and sketch to all sorts of different people. And when I do like corporate workshops, I really have to like remove every drop of jargon from what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because there's so much absolutely. And you forget how much there is until you're talking to people and they're like, I'm sorry, what? And they're like, what is this?
Yeah.
What do you mean short form versus long form? And I was like, oh, I don't need to explain this. They don't even know what improv is. Never mind the various different kinds.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you start doing, you know, you start like throwing out all your acting training and you're like, oh yeah, you know, Uta Hagen's 9 questions and Meisner's repetition exercises. And they just look at you with a blank stare. Yeah.
Find your center. Which part of your body are you focused on? Yeah. They love that. Where's in corporate your focal workshops.
Point? Yeah. Find your physical lead. They love that one.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful in team lead? Building.
Yes. What's your POV? That is a good one.
Oh man. So how did you get to short form? Like, where did your improv training come from and how did you take the short form games, I'm assuming, that you were doing and develop mm-hmm. that into an improvised play?
I was pretty quick. I was pretty witty as a boy, and so we would do a lot of improv stuff in like high school and just playing around. And I always liked improvising in rehearsal, much to the dismay of my directors, I'm sure. But it helped me, like, it helped me understand characters in scripted work. And then I went to, at the time it was called LA Theater Sports, or Los Angeles Theater Sports. And I started studying there. And they became Impro, and that's currently what they are. And they started doing full-length plays. So I was kind of doing the theater sports short-form game format things. And then I got cast in a Charles Dickens play, an improvised Charles Dickens play. And that first night with them was probably the scariest night of my life because it was a cast of 8. Including me, and 6 of the remaining 7 were my teachers at some point over my course. And it was like all people I just like idolized and looked up to. And we started doing this Dickens play, and everything happened so fast, and they were so quick, and they were so just on top of things. And we get to intermission, and the director was kind of going through each character and each actor and saying, who are you? What do you want? How do you feel? Who are you? What do you want? How do you feel? What's your relationship to the lead and blah, blah, blah. And they get to me and they're like, Chris, who are you? And I'm like, I haven't been on stage yet. And they're like, what? You haven't been on yet? And I said, no. And they said, well, make sure you get on in the second act. And I was like, okay. And so then all of a sudden, it was like 10 minutes to go before the play was supposed to end. And I still hadn't been on. So I'd literally spent like 70 minutes just sitting on the side. And I thought to myself, this is it. This is my moment. I'm going to be the guy that comes in at the end of the play and just wraps everything up in like one just super, you know, kick-ass monologue. And so the only way I could figure out how to get into this Charles Dickens play was I skydived into Victorian London and then came and gave this monologue. And that presented several problems, and the first of which was airplanes hadn't been invented yet, and the second of which there was no such thing as parachutes in Victorian London. So I came in and I tortured and just destroyed everything that they had spent 70 minutes creating. And I gave my monologue, and afterwards they were very receptive, and they came up and they hugged me and they said, good job. And we're proud of you for trying. And, you know, and then told me never to do that again. and so I fell in love with the idea of doing full length plays at that point. And then life happened and I left that group went to the Caribbean and came back. And when we opened Majeska Playhouse, we were just doing scripted shows for the first year. And then we decided to just do a night of short form games and just bring back short form games. And we did that. We did some short form nights and they were pretty fun. I had a good time. And then the second month we decided, well, let's do in the second act, let's do 45 minutes of short form games and then like a 45 minute romantic comedy. And so we did that, and then we really, really liked that. And then we just dropped short form altogether and just started doing plays, and the audiences kept and continue, hopefully, to keep coming and seeing the shows. And I feel a lot better now to not skydive into Victorian London.
Sure.
A little bit more confident now. Yeah, I direct several of them. Yeah, there's two or three of us that direct the shows, and we kind of take turns. And being the artistic director, even the director comes in and says, "Hey, you know, he or she will come to me, and we'll share ideas and advice and things like that." But yeah.
So then, the training that you have in improvised plays, was that when you were at Impro, or are you just saying that LA Theater Sports later became Impro? You didn't take classes there, but that's what it's called now.
I did. When I was taking classes, I think it was still called LA Theater Sports, and they were just turning into Impro when I left.
And they taught you how to do improvised plays?
I think they gave me the foundation or the idea of doing improvised plays. I tend to look at the unscripted plays more as a traditional actor or a traditional stage actor than I do an improviser, an improv actor. Because we don't go for the quick gag. We don't go for the quick, you know, button joke or anything. We tend to really think about how the characters and their relationships can drive the story over the course of 90 minutes. And what kind of situations can we put those characters in within the genre that we're doing to create dramatic and comedic tension. Mm-hmm. So I tend to look at it more of like a traditional actor, or, you know, some people would call it a legitimate actor, than I do as an improviser. So I think I took what I learned at Impro, and what I learned on the ships, to be honest with you, and then what I learned at acting school, and it's just kind of put it all together that way.
Interesting. Yeah, I wondered how you're, like, the current format that you're doing, like, you guys developed it on your own, like, this is the style, this is the way that we're going to do it. Do you guys, like, does the artistic direction decide what each one of the themes is for unscripted, or does the cast or director?
It's kind of a company-wide thing. We kind of sit there and go, you know, these are the genres that we'd like to look at. So for instance, when we did Agatha Christie or murder mysteries, we're like, well, that might be fun to try. And so we would go and we would read Agatha Christie novels, and we read like a lot of like Agatha Christie plays, and we started looking for the, you know, what was the format of how the plays worked, and what are the tropes, and who are the stock characters, and who are the character types, and how does that relate to like commedia characters or whatever, and or stock characters. And then mm-hmm. we start building the format in rehearsal. We start building the show in rehearsal. So the artistic director or the director kind of oversees everything and makes final decisions. But as a company or as a cast, we tend to figure out the style of the show from there. When we do the improvised Hallmark plays, I am probably going to start watching Hallmark movies in about a week, just so we can pick up, like, okay, here's the situation. They're almost always following a female lead because, mm-hmm. you know, it's a female-driven show. We always mm-hmm. see the female lead in her everyday life. Something, you know, we see how great her everyday life is. We see her with her boyfriend. We see her at the ad agency. We see her with her parents, you know. We see this. And then all of a sudden, she gets shipped to, you know, middle America, Kansas, to work on, to a small town. And so now she's a fish out of water. Okay, so we know that this happens a lot in Hallmark movies. And so we start looking at that and start rehearsing with that and start playing with that until we kind of create what the genre ends up being. So it's super organic. There's a ton of research. There's a lot of late nights sitting in bed with my dog watching really cheesy Hallmark movies and loving every second of it. God, I love them. I love them so much. You have no idea.
You guys do them every year for a reason, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, I swear to you, I will. My wife will be asleep and I'll be just like laying in bed blubbering because they finally got together. And you know that they're going to get together from minute one, but it doesn't matter. I love them so much. And they're so fun to do.
It's nice to see what's happened to Kirk Cameron as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm scared of the day that I age out of it, you know, that I can't play, that I have to go play the, you know, the dopey dad that only has two scenes. I fear the day that I age out of it, and it's probably coming closer. So we might have to.
When you age out of being the love interest?
Yeah, because the love interest is so fun. It's so fun because you get to put yourself in just ridiculous situations.
Hey, man, you can break the mold. This doesn't have to be a story about two 20-somethings falling in love. Who's to say
it's
that,
true.
You know, this isn't a widower's first Christmas?
It's true. I will probably be 70 years old in this tiny 54-seat theater and trying to play the love interest just because it's so fun. But, yeah.
What's Santa to do when after Mrs. Claus passes away? I'm just telling you.
Exactly.
There's so much to do. Old people are a staple of Christmas. Other times of year,
and now,
more bathing suit wearing times of year, I could see how it'd be tough to do. But during the winter,
that's true.
In.
That's true. And now I have I have reason to gain all this weight and become super like jolly and round because I have to play Santa.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Sullivan. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm going to blame you if that ever happens.
That's the title of this episode is I'm sorry, Mrs. Sullivan.
That's a pretty good one.
Oh, my God. That's so funny. Man, it's interesting. I've talked to a lot of people in a lot of different places about, you know, like how they develop their theater. And I think it's so fascinating when it comes from like a person who just takes all the knowledge that they have and you like put it together into something interesting, like as opposed to just following along and doing the same, you know, doing the same plays every year at like a regional theater or, you know, doing the same improv setups, you know, oh, we're doing the Herald. Yeah, cool. So is everybody else, like that kind of stuff. You know, it's interesting to hear it come all together. And it seems like a nice collaborative effort within your company.
Yeah, I think that I'm pretty proud of that, to be honest with you, because there's six of us that are main company and, at least three of them were former students of mine at different levels, which is pretty rad. And then one of the others, this main company, she was just an actress in one of our scripted shows. And we just saw something in her and we brought her in. And then another one worked with me at South Coast Rep early on when I was there. So it was just really a bunch of people that had a really cool vision and a really good collaborative effort to try to create something new. You know, I think we're one of the only theaters in Orange County that does this. I know we're the only one that does it as a main stage show, where it gets like a full run. I mean, we'll be doing 16 Hallmark movies in December, 16 improvised plays, over 4 weeks. So, yeah,
wow.
It's super cool. Someday I hope it'll make money. Like, I mean, for my pocket, that is.
Sure.
But, you know.
You said that the improv makes more money than the scripted, though, huh?
Yeah, those shows, we sell better with the unscripted shows than we do with our scripted shows. Partly because I think we're the only ones doing it. Partly because we're pretty good at it, and partly because we market it really, we like the company itself, the six of us, markets really, really well, and has a lot of friends. And we started to develop a following too, which is pretty cool. People come specifically for the unscripted shows. And there's a lot of return guests. Like we'll have people come for the Christmas show. They'll come once a week, you know. After you've seen Christmas Carol, you're done. You've seen it. But the unscripted shows, they'll come like every Saturday for 4 weeks just to see how the shows are changing and how they're different.
Oh, believe me, I know about the Christmas Carol. I did my, right after college, when I got my theater degree, I spent my next 5 years doing the rounds at regional theaters, and boy, howdy.
Yeah.
Every December.
Yeah.
A different
city's
Christmas Carol. You're like, all right, let's see how you guys are going to do it. Oh, it's totally the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like South Coast Rep, I think they've been doing it for 40 years or something. I mean, don't get me wrong.
I love it. I'll watch it once.
Oh, it's great.
You're right.
It's great. Yeah. It's great. But it's pretty fun to do something different. So
yeah, what you guys are doing is like so much more exciting and so much more filled with life. And like, I bet you gets you guys super into the Christmas spirit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, super, super, super. You know, they decorate the lobby. The set's completely decorated. It looks like a over-the-top Hallmark Christmas movie set. And
I mean, everything's super positive in those movies. Like, everybody learns a lesson. At the end, everyone's, like, super nice to each other, and they, like, appreciate each other. Like, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's super fun. And our audiences love it. And, you know... those were the first really big, like, successful unscripted show we did. And now, you know, the Agatha Christies were really successful as well. And spy thrillers were really fun. And we got to do, like, improvised stage combat every night, which was just off-the-hook scary. you know, throwing each other off fake buildings and skydives and fist fights and gunfights and it was really fun. My favorite part about Murder Mysteries was we never knew who the killer was. Like we don't pre-plan anything. So the only thing that we knew had to happen in Murder Mysteries was right before intermission, somebody had to die because it was just, it was a trope. It was an Agatha Christie, like it was a plot point right before intermission, somebody dies. And so we never knew who the killer was, and we didn't know why the person died. So you spend the first act trying to justify why you could kill anybody in the play. So then when somebody dies, you're like, okay, it could be me. And then as the second act starts to progress, you go backstage, and we have prop tables and, you know, and props and costume pieces. And you start noticing, like, the prop guns and the prop knives are starting to disappear. And you're like, okay, I have a prop 38 in my jacket, but there's four more somewhere in the theater. And some other actors have the prop 38s. So somebody else thinks they might be the killer. And it's never decided until one actor comes out and says, I did it. So it was always a surprise to us every night. And it was so fun.
That is so fun.
So crazy fun.
I did a murder mystery show for 6 years, and it was the same killer every time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they were super, super duper fun. And then that person, once they decided that they were the killer, they then had to do a monologue justifying why they killed not only the first person, but everybody else they killed in the second act.
Sure.
And it was, it was so fun. It was one of my favorite things to do. And we would do, our typical first acts were about 50 minutes, and we would only do two scenes. So the first scene would range anywhere between 30 to 40 minutes of just no blackouts, just one big scene in one single location, with characters coming on and off and living within the environment. And then we would have a blackout, and then we'd have a scene that reveals that somebody dies. It was crazy fun.
How many years have you guys been doing the unscripted shows or doing the theater in general?
The theater itself sort of started in 2008, but we didn't have a space, so we were doing like we were borrowing parks and things, and doing like one show a year. But we got our own space in 2015. We did our first show in April of 2015, and then the unscripted shows came in February of 2016. So since February of 2016, and it's been a pretty constant thing ever since.
That's great.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Now, I know that you took a sort of self-imposed lull while you were doing, quote, adult things like being a ship captain.
Yes.
But, But I wanted to ask you sort of as like a final wrap-up question to our chat, and thank you so much for sharing all your stories with me, is whenever you have a slump, like whenever you are having a hard time or you're just not, you know, you're not feeling inspired, what is your personal way of getting out of that? What do you do to like keep yourself excited?
I go to the mountains. If I need to, I think sometimes just what happens is I need to step away from doing shows and I need to step away from the theater for a little while. So I either go to the climbing gym and try to get some climbing in, or I go camping, or I go ride my bike, or I just get away from it until I miss it so much that I have to come back to it. And then I come back pretty rejuvenated. And then about halfway through the rehearsal process, I'm wishing I was in the mountains again. So I'm just never satisfied. I think I tell everybody, people ask me like, what's your dream job? Are you doing your dream job running a theater company and doing improv all the time? And I say it's certainly one of my dream jobs, but the other one is like, I want to be a national park ranger. I think that would be the raddest job in the history of man. And I looked into it for a while when we thought we weren't going to open the theater space, but man, they have, you have to have crazy degrees to be a park ranger.
Really?
Forestry degrees, environmental science degrees, biology degrees, geology degrees. You have to have all this crazy science stuff. And I was like, man, I just want to go hiking and tell people about the redwoods. It just isn't that easy anymore. So that's kind of what I do. I get away from it so I can come back to it, I think.
Maybe someday you can run like a mountain hostel. You can like run a little spot where people stay and you can just be up there and you can occasionally entertain and you're just like an old man with a bottle of wine when people show up and you're like, oh, hello, welcome to the chalet.
Don't tease me. And don't tell that idea to my wife, because she will kill you.
Legit, though, as a vacation, like, okay, so you don't have to make that your life. However, as a vacation, let me just tell you, in college, I went to this mountain hostel in the Alps, like in the Swiss Alps. Like, I'm in Switzerland. Oh. They're like, let's go to the Alps. I take, like, a bus to a cable car to, like, a burrow, and then, like, I get brought to this mountain hostel, which essentially is just a hostel, an open house. No one's in it. Just me and my two friends. There's nothing else on this like cliff. And that's it. And they're like, here it is. And I was like, this is it.
Heaven.
Yeah. It was
that's
wild.
Heaven.
Yeah.
That's heaven. I tell my wife I'd rather sleep in a tent than home in a bed. I just it's perfect.
Oh my goodness. Well, hey, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to chat with me, share your stories with me. I really appreciate all the information, and what a great resource for people in the Orange County area that they are able not only to see your shows, your unscripted shows, but also that they can find you at OC School of the Arts or South Coast Rep. As a teacher of performance. and they can learn from you as well. Do you teach classes at the theater at the Modesca? Modesca?
We do teach. See, it was a terrible name choice. But yes,
so
we
sorry.
Do. We teach. That's okay. You're not the first. We do teach classes at Modesca, and we're actually. I think I'm going to start. I think I have classes starting in January. Right now, one of our other company members is teaching a beginning narrative class. So, kind of teaching our style of improv. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's all good.
I said the name wrong, but I heard it correctly in my head. Though the first time before I figured out how to say it before I talked to you, I was thinking it was like, I don't know if you watched the television show The Americans. But there's a character named Nadezhda, and so I was like, maybe that's what this is. Maybe this is Nadezhda. So
we're just taking a play off of an American character. Yeah, it's
like common Russian name, so I wasn't sure. You know.
Yeah. No, we don't take any offense when anybody says the name wrong because we say it wrong all the time. My dad still says it wrong.
So, well, it's probably good that your website is MPH then. So they can't get
really
it wrong in the spelling.
Because it used to be ModescaPlayhouse.org and nobody would find us. So we changed it. And we're pretty smart on that one.
Yeah. Well, I hope you still own the other one and just redirect it so that the people who are like super like, I figured it out, can get there, you know.
Yeah. Now you're speaking Greek to me. Remember, I don't know anything about computers. But yeah, I think so.
I'm sure the tech people are doing exactly correctly, whatever the right thing
to
do
is. I'm sure they are.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, and enjoy all of your upcoming rehearsals and all of the wonderful Hallmark movies you get to watch.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. Bye. Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.